Hi, welcome to the Now Spinning Magazine podcast with me, Phil Aston. And on this episode, I'm absolutely delighted to be joined by Pete Bingham from Sendelica.
Now, good morning, Phil.
Good morning. Now, I've mentioned this band and featured this band several times on the Now Spinning Magazine platforms. And when I heard the first album, I described them by saying, imagine the Doors were having a jam with Jefferson Airplane, the Grateful Dead, Iron Butterfly and Blue Cheer, while the vocalists are having a drink in the local bar next door. And then I got the latest one, which I'm going to talk about extensively, One Man's Man.
Yeah.
I said, imagine again, because imagination is very important, I feel, with your music. We're standing at the top of the stairs in a music club in 1973, and the music is rising up through the stairwell to meet you. It's drawing you down the stairs to meet it. The room is dark, with only the outlines of the musicians on stage being visible. The music rides in a sea of synths and tracks extended across the whole side of orange or multicolored vinyl. This is the sound of Sendelica. So, welcome, Pete.
Thank you.
I think we need some context. So, because your band is so unique, how did you start in music? What are your origins?
It's quite funny. I'd been in a lot of previous bands and became very disillusioned with everything, with record labels and just the business in general. And I actually formed Sendelica as a thing to have fun with on a Sunday afternoon. And we used to book, we have a theatre local to us, and we used to book a room in there. And we used to just jam. And it was really just a celebration of all the things that I loved when I was a child, when I was a teenager. So I was very heavily influenced by, well, the first three bands I ever saw were Pink Floyd, Gong and Hawkwind. And that was, my life was never going to be the same, really, after that. And it was purely for something to do for fun. And we used to get together on a Sunday afternoon, and we used to record and used to give friends CDs. And it kind of snowballed from there, really. Suddenly one guy rang me one day out of the blue asking us if we wanted to do a gig. So we went from this kind of completely fun thing to, we decided then that anything we were offered to do, we would accept. So we had this, we went from one kind of mad thing to another, really. And a friend of mine, Colin, who produces a lot of the Sendelica stuff and plays keyboard on a lot of the Sendelica albums, he kind of nagged me to put some tracks up on MySpace. And another musician got in touch with us and said, oh, I really like your band. And I'm signed to a label in Russia called Reg Records.
Oh, yeah.
He says, I'm going to tell them about you. And I just thought, yeah, of course, you know.
Yeah. We all have those calls.
Yeah, exactly. And then about a month later, I got an email from this record company in Russia. And we signed with them for three albums. So we the album did nothing over here, but it got really, really good reviews in America. And the band in America actually got in touch with me and asked me if I'd go and play guitar on an album they were recording in Boston. So under the new rules, I had to say yes. So I went to Boston and I recorded with this band, and I met some other musicians over there. And they all said, oh, you have to come over and do a tour. So we did. The next year, we went and toured the East Coast of America. We played the Knitting Factory in New York, which was incredible. John Zorn's venue.
Oh, wow.
And we did another two albums then with this Russian label. And then we ended up touring Russia a couple of times. And we did the Eastern European tour. And it kind of just, everything just snowballed from there, really. And they'd all been just CD releases. And one day I thought it'd be really nice if we had something out on vinyl. So I made a little list of record labels that were in the UK. And I think the third person I messaged was Fruits de Mer. And about 10 minutes later, he messaged back and he said, oh, this is really bizarre because I've just been having a conversation with this woman in America who's appeared on one of their singles, one of their early singles, and she was really raving about your band. She'd been to see us play in New York. And that's how the Fruits de Mer connection came about. And we did a covers. At the time, they were only releasing cover version singles. I think we did Venus and Furs and Maggot Brain. It was a very unusual seven-inch. And, that was the beginning of our relationship with Fruits de Mer.
And it's a perfect partnership, isn't it? I mean, they are just as esoteric and out there on the edge.
Keith is just brilliant, and the most dangerous thing is for me and Keith to have a conversation, and we just the madness just kind of escalates, really.
The band started from, as you say, getting together for some fun and having some jams and stuff. When you were suddenly, obviously, this idea of you always have to say yes. So when someone actually booked you for a gig, did you have an orthodox set list? Or was it
No. We've never had a set list. We are such an improvising band that I think that's one of the reasons why the fans really enjoy all the live stuff that we put out, is that it's so radically different from, you know, one gig to the next. So all of our songs, we kind of have a set list in our head, but all the songs have a beginning and have an end, and sometimes they have a middle, and whatever happens between those bits is really, you know, is just on the night. And I really love Can for that. You know, every gig they ever did was completely different. They never had a kind of plan of what they were going to do or anything. So I kind of really like that idea, you know.
Yeah, because I guess it's, for a lot of musicians, my wife is a classically trained violinist, and her world is very much, when she was growing up, was about everything has to be written down and everything is structured and everything basically follows a pattern.
Yeah.
I mean, and obviously my background was rock music. So when we met, it was kind of like I needed probably a little bit of structure in my approach to music.
Yeah.
And for Sue, it was like letting go of the rail and just seeing what would happen in those gaps between the beginning and the end.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think why I love your music so much is that you can tell, even for the stuff that's down on record, that there's an element of you just turn left when the listener might have thought you were going to turn right.
And I think that's why we've become more and more focused on much longer tracks, because the journey is quite amazing. You know, I was never really into that kind of 4-minute pop song psychedelic thing. You know, I appreciate the Beatles and I appreciate the Kinks and I appreciate whatever, but it doesn't really talk to me. You know, it doesn't really make my soul sing, really. And I think that's why I was really drawn so much to bands like Hawkwind and stuff. That was completely a journey, you know, very much so.
Because I think the other thing about the music is the fact that it is adventurous. And the other thing I was going to say is, although I've said in my little preamble, oh, imagine you're back in 1973. Well, in fact, if you did, I still don't think, as much as you sound like from that, you're recreating that era. Yeah. If you had been back then, the record labels wouldn't have allowed you to do what you're doing now.
No. Yeah. And I think as well, is that although we're heavily influenced by the past, the 70s, you know, our kind of heroes of the 70s, we do drag the whole kicking and screaming into the 21st century, you know, and I'm really proud of that. You know, I'm not really a complete nostalgia freak. I do like to bring, you know, the modern things into it.
Well, you've got all those modern sounding synths and bit of techno background. It's it's very trance hypnotic, and it is very contemporary. For those of you listening to this or watching this thinking, oh, you pigeonholed the band as being like Floyd, Gong and Hawkwind. Yeah. It isn't. Yeah.
I listen to a lot of music. I mean, I'm a real big fan of people like Portishead and Massive Attack and The Orb. And I think all of that kind of comes into
it. It's in there, isn't it?
We do draw all that into us, you know.
But is it like the freedom of knowing, especially, do you think through the world of vinyl now, thinking, well, this is going to be 20 minutes. Look, this is going to be 20 minutes. This is going to be a whole side.
Definitely. Very much so. Yeah. Vinyl has become so important to us again that, yeah, I definitely do. You know, in fact, sometimes we've just done the third album of the series at the moment. And that's, some of the tracks were like 27 minutes long and stuff. It's, oh my God, it's not going to fit on vinyl, you know. Yeah. You're going to have to kind of like trim it back a little bit. So yeah, definitely it is a consideration.
Are you involved with the whole kind of visual concept as well of the vinyl?
Oh yes, yes, very much so. Me and Colin, yeah, very much involved in that, yeah.
Yeah, because I remember, was the first one I actually bought was this
Public.
One.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know the color, you know the purple blobs, and you know it's just it looks great going around on the turntable.
Yeah, well, that's very important. Visual aspect is very important.
It is,
but
yeah.
You know, the sleeves are really important to us. We've never been a band for like putting pictures of ourselves on the sleeves and whatever. You know, it's. I think it is part of the whole package, very, very much so.
Yeah. So the Syndelica journey, of course, has also created some kind of satellite projects, hasn't it?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, yeah. I couldn't kind of do everything that was in my head with Syndelica, so other things began to emerge. Yeah, so
I'd love to talk about this one.
Yeah.
Which is a combination between Star Trek and...
well, Dave would love that.
Yeah. I mean, your imaginative kind of thoughts came together on this. You've got all those spoken voices floating around over this background of, as you say, modern contemporary trance with the past in amongst it. Yeah. How did you come up with this as a idea?
Well, Dave, the guy who did it was just a duo. It's me and Dave Owen.
Wow.
I've known him for probably over 30 years. I knew him when I lived in Leeds. And I used to run a record label at one point for Rough Trade, Red Rhino, as it was at the time. And I put a single out by his previous band, which was called The Hollow Men. And we had just a really good, strong friendship. And about 3 or 4 years ago, he asked me if I could mix the first Band of Cloud album, which I did, and he was really happy with it. And then it was just a logical thing. Then he said, "Do you fancy doing an album together?" You know, so that was how it came about. Yeah,
because it's very, very unusual. As you say, you're down as playing guitars, beats, loops, field recordings.
I love field recordings. In fact, there's field recordings on almost all of the Syndelica stuff kind of in the background, you know.
How do you approach those, the field recordings? What was your kind of...
I have a little Tascam recorder that I just take everywhere with me. And whenever I'm anywhere, whether it's bird sounds or industrial sounds or anything really, I use them as a bit of the backing in it, yeah.
I'm really pleased you've mentioned that, because that is something that's in there. It's another thing that makes up the overall tapestry of sound, isn't it? That you don't actually realize. It's another thing that makes this such a different experience.
Yeah, very much.
Yeah, because I had a couple of people in the now spinning Facebook community say things like that. It's like nothing else. because you get in traditional rock music or whatever, there's the gaps between the instruments. There's the drums, there's the bass, the guitar and the vocals or keyboards, and these spaces. But in Syndelica, there's like other stuff.
There's lots of things swirling around.
Yeah, there's lots of things coming
to the foreground and disappearing again. And I really love that. You know, it's like taking people on a voyage, taking people on a journey. And that really, really appeals to me. I do love that a lot.
So as you like, basically, it sounds like putting together like the ultimate meal with all these different ingredients. When you approach the recording process, do you approach it in a traditional way? It probably is drums, bass, guitars, and then add on everything on as your imagination, wherever your imagination takes you.
Well, actually, we have two really, really different ways of working. Like the series of Cromlech albums, the Cromlech 1, 2, 3, and 4. We actually used to go to a recording studio, Monkey, which is where the Cromlech is from. It's actually in their grounds of the studio. And we usually book it for a weekend, and we kind of just jam as a full band. And then we take those things away, and then we kind of work on them. And that was really interesting. It was almost like a commune for the weekend, really. And we'd invite certain people over and things and kind of jam with different people. But then the last three albums, the third album's not out yet, the One Man's Man and the Man, Myth and Magic, it was a completely different way of approaching it, in that Colin and I kind of composed things together, and then we got the rest of the band to add stuff to it. So it was a very different way of working.
Interesting. So when I was just thinking then, as you were talking, that the way people traditionally approach the studio, they find it quite stressful sometimes because so many bands, you know, will say, live is much better. I prefer that. I don't like the kind of clinical aspect of the studio. I have to be really focused on what I'm doing. Is there a lot more freedom in how you approach recording?
Definitely. I think as well that the whole kind of business of recording has changed so much over the last 20, 30 years. I mean, the first proper band I was in had Ian Nelson, which was Bill Nelson's brother, in it, playing sax and keyboards. And I remember we had a couple of days in the studio, and it was very stressful because you just felt you had to get certain things done and it had to be finished, and you had to mix it all actually at the studio and everything. And now it's completely changed. You know, although we do go to conventional studios sometimes when we're recording as a full band, but otherwise, you know, all the mixing and everything we do at home on our computers, and it's actually quite like it. You know, I quite like not having that stressful thing. And the thing of playing live in the studios now that I find is that sometimes you make mistakes, but the mistakes are the interesting things. You know, it's because we're not writing 3 or 4 minute pop songs or rock songs or whatever kind of songs as such, is that, you know, you have that space and to be able to experiment with things, you know. And it's
I guess another area where you've created this freedom for yourselves as creative people is that a lot of people, when they approach going to record in the studio, they know that at some point they're going to have to recreate this live, but you don't have that.
No. I mean, I don't think we play anything live from I think it's one track from the last album we play live sometimes, but it's not something that's foremost in our thoughts when we're recording albums. We view it as completely separate things, you know, separate entities.
Yeah, so a bit like Tangerine Dream in a way, in the 70s, they didn't, when you went to see them live, they didn't play anything that from the albums you actually owned.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I remember going to see Tangerine Dream in Sheffield, I think it was about 1976, and it was just quite mind-blowing. You know, it was just incredible to see such freedom. I remember Edgar Frost strapped on a Les Paul at one point, and it was like, oh my God, you know. It was, as you said, when you listen to things like Rubicon and Phaedra and stuff, you know, it wasn't guitar-based at all. It was just these really floaty synth songs and stuff. And it was like, yeah, it was great. It was brilliant.
So weren't you, because of the way you approach putting your work down, and you can obviously put lathes and synths and stuff on it.
Yeah.
How do you know when you're done? How do you know when you think, yes? Is it like a painter? You could keep touching up little bits, thinking, you know.
Yeah, well, that's possibly the downside of the modern technology of recording wise. So yeah, I think there's often deadlines though, which kind of focuses, and such as the problem with having vinyl press at the moment. I mean, the lead times are getting longer and longer. So Keith at Fruits of the Moor will say, you know, well, I needed by, you know, last week or whatever. And so that does, so you do still get that kind of focus of it, yeah.
What's the inspiration behind the song titles and the actual music, though? You know, there's kind of an otherworldly ancient land and, you know, kind of almost like ancient spirituality in amongst it all. Is it what's?
Very, very much so. I live in Cardigan in West Wales. And only a few miles from here is a place called Pendra Ifan, which is a burial chamber, burial mound, with the remains of it.
Yeah.
And it's that area is known as the magical landscape. And it has had a big influence on my music, very much so. And there's always this quandary of, was it a magical landscape and that's why these ancient people actually went there and built these things? Or is it a magical landscape because they built these things? And it's always kind of, a question that's never going to be answered for us. But it has a big influence on the music we make, definitely.
I live in the far west of Cornwall, which has got the highest density of stone circles and standing stones, I think, anywhere in the UK.
Yeah.
And I think that was one of the reasons when I first started to listen to you and look at the artwork and everything, that I was drawn towards it. It has got that kind of feeling.
Yeah, very much so, yeah.
And driving out to one of the most accessible stone circles down here is called Merry Maidens, and having your music on in the car, driving towards that location, seems right.
Yeah. There's almost that kind of druidic theme going through a lot of our albums that we've done.
Yeah.
And the last three albums have been... I've been kind of like focused on religion and what makes, you know, what makes a man, you know. It's a big kind of quandary among scientists. When did we become mankind, you know?
Yeah.
And it just kind of really fascinates me. Religion, I'm not a religious person at all, but I find religion incredibly fascinating, you know, that I think even from, you know, when we were living in caves, there was this need to try to explain things.
Meaning.
And have a meaning to it all. And I think that kind of became religion and just that whole thing. And, you know, what are myths and, you know, what is magic? You know, what is the whole thing of it is quite a fascinating subject to me.
Well, the album that I've played the most by yourselves is this one.
Yeah.
I absolutely love it. And I know it's very popular with members of Now Spinning as well.
Yeah.
And the first side is very different to the other three sides in that that's kind of the heavier, you know, you know, there's more guitar riff centric and there's almost like a Born
to
Be Wild.
It's the more Black Sabbath-y side of it.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. I just love the first Black Sabbath album, and it's just I think it was definitely a nod and a homage to Black Sabbath.
It is, but you've got that whereas I think the constraints of a band back then or even now in more kind of orthodox music business will be kind of reining that in, thinking, well, I've done that long enough, I can't, you know, we'd have to cut that off. But there's a sense of freedom in the way that you know, there's two tracks on that side, but they segue together so easily.
Yeah.
They just feel as if they're joined at the hip, don't they?
In fact, the second half of that side, it was actually, although I don't think many people have actually noticed, was heavily influenced by Television, the band Television.
Was it?
You know?
Right.
Yeah. Very much so, you know. It's kind of like a Hawkwind Television. But I love that kind of a Television guitar sound. It was just stunning. Yeah, it was just mind-blowing in its own way.
Yeah. The approach to production is really, I think, really different. It's is it because you play so many different things, guitars, bass, synths, the guitars aren't kind of like really forefront in the mix, even when you're soloing, they're kind of, everything is, everything is at the right level.
Nothing. I think everything kind of meshes together and sometimes things come floating to the top and then the dive bomb back down. And it is, I don't think anyone wants to listen to a 20-minute guitar solo or a 20-minute drum solo or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's that whole way, the whole way that everything weaves together, you know, it's...
I think there's one instrument that does, I think, define and make the sound of Sendelica to me beyond the guitars and synths, and it's the sax. From Lee.
I mean, very much,
That really, to me, sets off this otherworldly kind of gongy kind of feeling. I mean, how long's Lee been involved? He's a brilliant player.
We did a gig probably about 12, 13 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And Lee was playing in the support band. And he kind of stood at the side of the stage and watched us all the, you know, when we did our set. And afterwards he came to me and he said, oh, yeah, I'd really love to be in a band like this, you know. And I think Glenda had actually been in a band with him a long time ago with Nick Turner.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Well, that was Nick Turner's All-Stars. So they'd kind of crossed paths within that. So, yeah, it just became a natural thing. And he started doing a bit of recording with us, and then he started playing live gigs with us. So, yeah, he's been kind of in and out of the band quite a lot, really. Yeah. And even though he's not in the live version of the band anymore at the moment, he still does record with us. Yeah.
When he does record, because I don't know if his background is kind of in jazz or...
Very much jazz. Yeah. Yeah. The band he was in when they supported us was very much a jazz band. Yeah.
So his parts, is he like playing literally live over the top and it's just he's going in the moment?
With the Cromlech albums, he was actually in the room with us, you know, so we were all improvising, really. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. So, I mean, I would, when we did the things at Monkey Studio for the Cromlech albums, that I would have some riffs and things that I'd been working on at home, but the band would never hear them till we actually went to the studio, and then I would just start playing, and then we would see what would develop. And sometimes they just go completely different directions to what was originally there, you know. So he's often in the room with us doing. Yeah.
Now, I think again, talking to you and realizing that so much of the music is just literally created in the moment, apart from maybe a few signposts to say this is when we're going to end.
Yeah.
But because of that, you're not like a band that comes along and saying we've got 12 tracks to record and we have only got one extra one if we're forced to do one.
Right, yeah.
It comes across that you could just keep... You've got four sides of vinyl and you've filled them.
Yeah.
But if someone said you could do another album in 8 weeks, you could say, yeah, we could do that.
Yeah. Well, we often have. You know, we've done recording sessions and we've come out with two double albums. One for one label in Germany and one for another label,
really?
You know, one for Fruits de Mer. Yeah, definitely.
Oh,
it has,
wow.
So, it has happened. Very much so, yeah.
Well, I mean, I've got to go to this next band next, the Lost Stone Pandas.
Ah, yes.
And Dark Side of the Noom 1 and 2. Well, tell me about this further adventure.
I have a really good friend called Chris Needs, who is a very good journalist and a very good writer. And he used to be the editor of Zigzag magazine.
Oh, yeah,
70s.
I remember. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was a big fan of Zigzag. I used to buy lots of albums purely from the recommendations of it. So he was quite a big influence on my teenage years, you know, and he was only a teenager himself. He's only a couple of years older than me. And about 5 or 6 years ago, I had an email from Keith at Fruits de Mer saying there was this guy called Chris Needs had been in touch with him, and he was trying to chase down some Sendalica albums that he was missing from his collection. Mm-hmm. And Keith passed them on to me because there were albums that hadn't been released on Fruits de Mer. So I kind of wonder if this is the same Chris Needs that was in Zigzag magazine, you know? And sure enough, I got in touch with him, and sure enough it was. And he was a massive fan of the band, and he really tried to help us in a lot of ways. And I talked to him a lot. And I remember one night we were sending some panda gifts to each other, just ridiculous things about pandas. And he said, oh, we should form a band. We should call them the Giant Pandas. And I said, oh, that's a really good idea. But I said, let's call it the Lost Stone Pandas. And he was friends with Alex of The Orb at the time as well.
Yeah.
They're very good friends. They go back a long way. And he became involved a little bit in it. He did some remixes of some tracks.
Yeah.
And I remember having a conversation with Chris with through Alex, and Alex had said something like, Chris had said to him, how do you fancy being in the Lost Storm Pandas? And Alex said, well, I've been stoned a lot, but I've never been a panda, so I'm definitely up for that. So that was kind of quite nice, you know. That was a nice little kind of, for me, was a full circle kind of thing, you know, being a big influence on me, so.
Well, I think that for those of you who are very new to this band and the music, for those of you watching and listening, because I've said it's called the Lost Stone Pandas and it's called Dark Side of the Noom, you might think it's kind of a jokey kind of album, but it's a really, both of them are really, really wonderful pieces of music. And I mean, you've got like these guitars, as you say, you've got rhythms and sounds and stuff, but you've also got cello, violin, viola and bass. You've literally got almost a string quartet on both albums.
Yeah, yeah. And it's kind of gone back to that thing of what you were saying about your wife being a classical violin player. I've always, always wanted to jam with some classical musicians, but it's never been possible because they just don't understand improvising at all, you know? Mm-hmm. And I was really lucky that Sandelica did a gig with Curved Air quite a few years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And Paul Sachs, who's their violin player at the time, it was just amazing. And I was talking to him afterwards. He goes, oh, I really love what you're doing with this band and stuff. And when the Lost Storm Pandas idea started getting floated around, I got in touch with him. And he said, yeah, he was really up for it. And I'd known a cello player for quite some time, and she was up for it as well.
Yeah.
And so it was great. The first couple of Pandas albums are actually us all improvising live in the studio at Monkey Studio.
All of you?
All of us, yeah.
So no one is kind of anchoring it down to a specific pattern. Everybody?
No, again, I just went in with a couple of guitar riffs and things and said, played it to them, and then they were like, oh yeah, I've got some ideas for that. And then we literally just went in and we do like three or four takes of a track, and they got longer and longer each time we did it. And it was, that was it. And it was just marvelous to find some classically influenced musicians who could and were willing to improvise.
And you didn't, so literally you would have like, say, you'd record three takes, but you didn't then take something from that one and stick it on that one.
No. It always used to be a full,
It's a full thing, a full live, nothing's tampered with.
Yeah.
Well, that's fantastic, because I have to say that I have played both of these a lot. Are they both still available from?
Yes, they are. Yes, they're both still available on vinyl, and I think there's maybe some CDs left as well. Yeah, but and it was great, and it was kind of a fulfillment for me, that something that I'd always wanted to do. If I remember when we toured Russia, which was at least 10, 11 years ago now, we had a chance. There's a place in St. Petersburg called the House of Composers, which is where they used to actually do the manuscripts
at
the time. And it's actually now a recording studio. They actually have a valve mixing desk.
Wow.
Yeah, so you go in and they switch it all on. And then for about half an hour, you have to wait till it warms up, and they give vodkas out to everybody.
Yeah.
And I'd really, really hoped that I was going to be able to record with some classical musicians there.
Yeah.
And they got some people in to do it with us. But as soon as we said, they were saying, well, where's the music written down? And where's, you know, and they just said, well, no, I just want you to improvise. Oh, no, we can't do that. You know, and that was a really, really big disappointment. But then 10 years later, I got the chance to do that with these people. And we had a great time. It was a really great weekend, and we all came back together again and did it again, you know.
So, wow. Well, how did you come up with the name of the Dark Side of the Noom?
Well, that was a very drunk Colin. I think it was after the first night of recording at Monkey. And he kept saying, we should call this the Dark Side of the Noom. And it just became the thing. Yeah, yeah.
It just happened. But The design, the little stickers and everything. That's all part of you as well? The concept of what the
We designed the panda logo and everything, and we did the whole thing with the light going through the panda and coming out all the different colors. You know, very much so.
And is this a purely studio based unit, or was it ever played live?
It is, yes. It is studio only.
You ever thought about thinking what it'd be like to play almost with the
We were booked to do a gig at Leeds O2 by this turned out to be a very dodgy company, and I think Bartley James Harvest and Big Train were on the bill. And it all just kind of fell apart, and Big Train and Bartley James Harvest were very, very upset about the whole thing. And so that we were committed to doing that one-off gig as a kind of one-off thing. We were going to do it, but sadly it never happened. But who knows, one day in the future.
Well, I guess especially if you've got musicians who are very relaxed into being able to improvise.
Yeah.
You know, apart from miking them up, they're just ready to go, aren't they?
yeah, very much so. Yeah. I think Kate doesn't like loud noises, so she did. So yeah. So we actually put her in the drum booth.
Oh.
We had the drums actually in with us, but she had a drum booth. She's the cello player, and so she just had headphones on because she really doesn't like loud noise.
Your whole image and the way that the all of the materials that go together, even the Fruits de Mer, the way they put out the press releases and everything, gives you this almost like mysterious, mythical kind of image. As you say, there's no pictures of you, no one really, you know. But your albums are becoming quite collectible, aren't they? I mean...
Yeah. I mean, that some of the prices, some of the things seem to go for now is quite eye-watering in many ways.
Every periodically do you repress them, or have you got thoughts about doing that or repackaging them?
We've retained all the rights to everything, so things do kind of come back to us after, you know. We've had deals in Russia. We had a really prolific releases with an Italian label called VE Records, Vincibus Eruptus.
Yeah.
And we did some stuff on a German label called Sun Hair, and we did some stuff on a French label. All of those, when they've sold out, the rights return to us again.
Wow.
Which has been quite handy, really. So, you know, we've been going 17 years now. So we've just re-released an album that was originally released as a CD only album on a Welsh label called Tidy Like Records, and they used to release everything in a little metal tin. So the CD was in the tin, and then it was stuffed with like goodies and incense sticks and things and badges and everything, luminous stars. So we just had the 15th anniversary of one of the albums we did with that. So we just re-released that on CD, and we did some lathe cut vinyls as well for the vinyl Manix.
Are you seeing more of a move towards vinyl from your fan base now that that's what people want?
Oh, definitely. We sell probably 3 or 4 times more vinyl than we do CDs. Yeah, very much so.
And are they quite short runs, or I mean, do you keep them?
The Fruits de Mer stuff tends to be, we tend to do 500 or 600 vinyl, and CDs we do a couple of hundred CDs. We've also started doing these USBs with all the outtakes and things on them as well, which are quite, seem to be really popular with people.
I think probably because the fact that some bands, when they say, well, there's a couple of outtakes on the end of this reissue.
Yeah.
You either can't tell the difference, or it doesn't sound like it should have been on there anyway.
Yeah.
I imagine from the way that you've described your whole creative process, that would be very popular because you're going to have a USB full of stuff you've never heard, and it's probably, and it will be just as good as everything that was on the official albums.
Yeah, yeah. It's like the Band of Cloud album. We did a USB for that. It came in a tin with a jigsaw to make up the cover. And I actually did a really ambient mix of the whole album, which lasted about, I think it's nearly an hour long, with loads of field recordings and really chilled mixes and things. And I think people have really loved them.
Going back to that album, it's got so many voices, like the Star Trek-y type things on it. That must be a lot of fun picking those out.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Yeah. Very much so. Yeah.
So
it's kind of, it gets people thinking as well from where they're from. It's like there's one part of this, it's like an LSD trip without the drugs, and it's like lots of people kind of ask, is that Alan Wicker doing that, you know? And it's so there's all these things. It piques people's interest, I think. Yeah.
What were the kind of TV programs that kind of influenced you? I mean, it seems an odd question.
I was a big fan of The Prisoner. And obviously being in Wales, I've been to Port Marion a few times.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And Time Tunnel, I really, really loved. Land of the Giants. Ah. That was, all those things were really, were big kind of influences, I think, really.
Now that you've mentioned them, it all makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. And Forbidden Planet, obviously, as well. The electronic music of that was just incredible. Yeah, it's just... amazing soundtrack.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? It was way ahead of its time. Was that the early 60s or late 50s? I can't remember.
Late 50s. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's incredible.
It's just quite mind-blowing to think how they actually did it, you know. And
yeah. But that's what I think, albums like this, as I said at the beginning, yes, you can hear it's music from another era, but it's also music from this era.
Yeah,
because this couldn't have been created any other time, I don't feel, but now.
Definitely. And that's as I was saying earlier, that's one of the really important things to me is to bring prog rock and psychedelia and things, but with a 21st century twist, you know. With, I don't want things to sound like, you know, I've met some bands and stuff when we've been on tour and things. We've toured a hell of a lot in Europe. And people go, oh, yeah, I really like this album, but the drums don't sound like they were recorded in 1969 or something. And it's like, well, what does that mean, you know? It's just stupidity to me. It's just, you know, we're living, you know, the 2020s now. It's not 1969 anymore.
No, it isn't, Tony. You're using the best of everything, really. Yeah. And I think that one of the things when I first started playing this record, and each time I played it, in fact, what I'm trying to say is that sometimes you play an album and it's an instant hit with the senses and you really like it.
Yeah.
And you're about to say it's the best, one of the best things you've heard. And then within quite soon, you start to get a bit tired or bored with it. There are other albums where you're not quite sure at first, but they grow on you. And over the, you know, the passing weeks and months and years, they become one of your favorites. What makes Sendelica different to me is that every time I listen to it, it's not the same.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to delve into. Yeah, there is a lot going on.
And you know, someone said to me the other week that you listen to a rock album and sometimes you can focus on the bass guitar or the guitarist the next time you listen to it. But there's so much happening here.
Yeah, yeah.
There's so many places to land and explore while you're doing your stuff. I think that's one of the things that makes the band so different.
I think one of the most interesting things that a kind of big fan has said to me over the years was that when a new Sendelica album arrives, they're never quite sure what it's going to be. So we're not kind of pigeonholed into, you know, regurgitating the same album over and over and over. And I think that's really nice that people can still be surprised. And
isn't that the true essence of progressive rock, if you like? I think we've moved into the situation where people if a band's now feels almost scared to move out of whatever worked before, they need to do another version of that. Whereas, as you say, when I was growing up in the 70s, the excitement of buying an album by one of my favorite bands was thinking, I wonder what they've done this time.
I think also going back to what you were saying before about this kind of mysterious element about Sendelica and the side projects and things is that I think we kind of, because we live in this era now of Googling everything and the internet and everything, people kind of forget that, you know, when I was a teenager, bands like Neu and Can were this incredible enigma that I didn't know anything about. I couldn't go on a computer and Google Neu or Google Can or, you know what they were all about or anything, you know. So I think that kind of mysterious element is kind of gone. And I'm trying to bring that kind of back a bit.
Yeah, well, I would say it's a really important thing. Yeah, very much succeeding in that as well. And also I think that what's wonderful to me to listening to music like this is it has that sense of wonder about it. It sounds exciting without being dramatic. It's kind of, it is the fact, the way you've, I thought before I spoke to you, I wonder how they create this music. And what you've said is almost what I imagined you were going to say. Yeah. But that's created even more of a spark of a sense of wonder to me when I listen to it now, is that this is to listen to. That's why people like bootlegs and live stuff, isn't it? Because I'm listening to somebody like Miles Davis create that in that moment, and it never existed ever again. Yeah. But you're capturing that on his studio albums, and obviously live, you just do it all the time.
Yeah. I think that's kind of that's a very apt description of how we view our work, really.
When are you going out on the road, or are you planning that, or are you?
Yeah, we've got a few festival gigs in the summer, and let's talk about doing a little tour of Finland later in the year, which we've been to a few times before in the past. And we've just finished recording the new Sendelica album, which is called Man, Myth and Magic, which will be out on Fruits de Mer in November.
Oh, that sounds really exciting. I guess it's going to be quite an elaborate kind of coloured vinyl package as well.
Oh yes, it'll be another die cut sleeve, and yes, the whole works. And we've actually designed a set of tarot cards,
and
which is going to be with a limited edition that Keith will be putting out.
That's fantastic. Because you're playing festivals, and again, because of the way you approach your music, do you almost ask how long have we got before you decide what you're going to play?
it was. In this country, it's always you just like given an hour, you know. Yeah. And I remember the first time we played in Germany, which was a big thing to us anyway, because, you know, so many of our heroes were
from
German
Germany,
band, you know, the Neus and the Cans and the Kraftwerks of the world. But I remember we did this festival in Würzburg, this big psychedelic festival, and it was in this medieval tower. And the promoter said to me, oh, how long have we got to play? And he goes, you can play as long as you like.
That's a scary thing to say to you guys.
So I think one of the tracks we did, because it actually came out as an album a year or so later, I think we managed a 42-minute version of a track that on album had lasted 10 minutes.
That's two sides of vinyl,
was,
isn't it?
Yeah, it was two sides. Yeah. Two sides and a bit, I think it was.
Yeah.
And the thing was the crowd were just so into it that we did have this ultimate kind of live experience that we were given to the audience, and the audience were given back to us, and we just kind of spiraled up and up and up. And it was an amazing gig, and it was an amazing experience.
Because the way that taps into what you were saying about, you know, the kind of ancient mythology around where you live and your interest in religion and the sense of meaning, to actually have that kind of experience as a musician where you play music that's in the moment and the audience is so connected to it. Yeah. And everyone's connected to that moment. That I can understand why that must have been very, very magical for
it
everybody.
Was, and I think that whole day, because it was the first gig we'd ever played in Germany, and it was such an amazing audience and such an attentive audience that it was just it was a milestone gig, and it was and it was really bizarre, because when we came off stage, I actually said to the promoter, "Oh, it's a great shame that we hadn't recorded that," and he goes, "Oh, actually, I have recorded it on a mobile unit upstairs." Oh. So it was there to be mixed, and we released it. It was a fantastic evening.
Is that still available? Is it?
No, it is finished now. Yeah, they've all gone, I'm afraid. There is a download available still on their Bandcamp, but yeah, it was amazing. And I remember the next time we went back to Germany, we had the albums to sell, and this young lad came up to the merchandise stall, and he goes, "Oh, have you got such and such?" And I say, "Yeah, yeah." And he goes, "Oh, I was at that gig, and it was the first time I'd ever taken acid." And he goes, "I'm really interested in here was what it's going to be like, you know, when I listen to it in the cold of day."
Yeah.
And we actually saw him again at another gig in Germany, and he said he really loved it. And it was just, it just brought back great memories of what a night it was.
What kind of things do you have in the Sendelica merch stall? Is it vinyl and CDs, or do you also have T-shirts and other?
Oh, we have T-shirts and, yeah, vinyl and CDs. We even had some cassettes, but that was a sell too far.
Yeah, that's true. It amazes me that CDs have made this, not CDs, cassettes have made this kind of little bump backwards, but I wonder whether they're just selling because they've been bundled in with other things that people are buying, you know.
Yeah. We were approached by a company, and they released two of our albums on cassettes, but then I think they went bankrupt. So I think that tells us everything we need to know.
There you go. Well, where's the best place for people to buy your music and albums? Well,
it's the Bandcamp Sendelica. That's the best place to go. And I think most of our albums are up on there. And they're all available as downloads, but there are CDs and vinyl of a lot of the stuff there.
Fantastic. Well, I'll make sure.
And all the Lost Storm Pandas and the.
So they're all available from the same Bandcamp page.
Yeah, it's all there. Yeah.
Well, they're highly recommended. They really, really are. Well,
thank you very much, Phil.
They really are. And I think that those of you who listened to this and watched it, the freedom you must have to record music and play music like that without the constraints of, like, saying, "Well, you've got an hour set." A lot of bands will be thinking, "Well, we can do seven songs and maybe we'll leave 5 minutes for the encore." You just think, "Well, we'll do that and we'll just see how it goes."
I think most of our gigs are two or three tracks.
another question then, because of the improvisational thing, before we go, is that what you play, and obviously anything to do with improvisational music is about how you feel inside, what kind of mood you're in and stuff. Do you feed off the atmosphere of the room and the
response? That's exactly what I was saying about the first gig we ever did in Germany, was that you feed from the audience, and then you're giving it back, and they're feeding, and it's like this, it's almost like this spiral, you know, just ever going over. And I think when we did the track that we did that lasted 40 odd minutes is a track called Master Benjamin. And I kept thinking that it was coming to an end, but the audience were just so into it that it just kind of took it into new directions, and it took it into new places we'd never been with the track before. And that, to me, it is the essence of a great gig, you know, when you're playing things completely differently and you're going in a completely different direction, and it's just wonderful, you know.
Are you the with so many of you kind of being lost in the moment, are you the master of ceremonies where you just...
Yes, I am. Yes. I'm the one they look to for the signs.
They look for the sign to go.
Yeah.
We're coming to the end of this, yeah.
We're coming to the middle bit now. You know, we all need to come down. Yes, very much so. Yeah.
Well, thanks very much, Pete. That's been really,
a pleasure.
Wonderful. And as I said to everyone watching and listening, it's a fantastic band and you must very least listen to this. You know, it's a fantastic journey for the whole mind, body, spirit, and every one of your senses. So thank you very much, Pete. And I'll put the links to where people can find you and buy your music. But it's been great stuff. And hopefully, keep me in the loop of what's going on. And talk to you very, very soon.
Thank you very much. Cheers, Phil. Thanks very much.
Thank you for watching and listening to this podcast with my special guest, Pete Bingham. What a great guy and an absolutely fantastic band. You know, really, really are. Please go to their Bandcamp page where you can buy directly from them. You know, honestly, you will really, really enjoy their music. I absolutely adore it. Thank you for subscribing to the YouTube channel. Please do if you haven't already. And this podcast, we're available on Apple, Google, Amazon, Spotify, everywhere. And check out the website, Now Spinning Magazine, which is at nowspinning.co.uk. And I shall see you on my next episode.